Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm chairman of the Natural Gas Programme at the Institute. It's my great pleasure to be joined today by Sarah Ladislaw, who's Senior Vice President and Director of the Energy Security and Climate Change Programme at the CSIS. And we're here today to discuss the key messages that came from her chapter, Lessons from a Strategy of Energy Dominance, that form part of the Oxford Energy Forum, The Geopolitics of Energy, Up with the Old and In with the New, that was published on the 8th of February 2021 by the Institute. Sarah, welcome to the OIS podcast series.
Thank you so much, David, for having me.
My pleasure. Or our pleasure, I should say. Okay, Sarah, why don't we open up by talking about kind of how you started your chapter. And it was the expression energy dominance. Could you perhaps explain to our listeners what you mean by this expression and why it's so important a concept in the US?
Sure, absolutely. Energy dominance is a concept, is a term that was used by the Trump administration when the president was campaigning. Right, it was a term used in a speech, and it resonated with people because it was sort of a outgrowth of a more familiar concept that's been around in U.S. Energy politics for a long time, which is energy independence, right? So when you think about the loss of, you know, independence when it comes to producing the oil, particularly, but also natural gas that the U.S. needs to be able to power its economy, you know, the loss of that, you know, independence in the 1970s when we, you know, were importing oil from other places and we experienced oil supply shocks in the Arab oil embargo. It was sort of this idea that's been around in U.S. energy policy circles for the better part of the last 50 years. And so what energy dominance was meant to signify was not only that the U.S. was in the position to be able to achieve energy independence, but also we had so much abundance in oil and gas that we could turn the script a little bit and be able to not just be sort of vulnerable to the world's oil market, but start to kind of call the shots. And so there's all sorts of things that went into it, but it was sort of a very somewhat aggressive and outwardly focused version of that old concept of energy independence.
Yeah, it has actually, from an outsider looking in, been fascinating to watch slowly as the US has kind of increasingly had greater security from energy. But perhaps you could set out for us the big change, of course, from the last few months. And by the way, for our listeners, we are recording this on the 10th of March, 2021, to kind of timestamp this discussion. But the biggest change, of course, in energy terms has been that you have had a change of president, in case you didn't know. So what does it mean to have President Biden, not President Trump, in the White House?
Yeah, so I think the biggest difference, and this is a difference that has held for the last couple administrations in the United States, which is, you know, Democrats increasingly feel as though the science and imperatives around doing something about climate change are worth the time and effort and policy maneuvers that are necessary to deeply decarbonize the world's economy. And so it is profound to have that as the central task underneath your energy policy, right? If you don't need to do that, particularly if you don't need to decarbonize the world's energy system by 2050, you wouldn't do it, right? There's no other reason to do it other than the sort of decarbonization agenda. And so, you know, this has been sort of a tension between Democrats and Republicans in the United States for a long time, with Republicans feeling like, you know, we could eventually, like, the world is generally going to be lower carbon and generally going to be less polluting, but, you know, we can't, you know, artificially speed up the rate and pace at which we're, you know, trying to move technology or make investment or replace infrastructure to be able to reach those objectives. Whereas the Biden administration has said, no, this is a central goal. It is not only a central goal in sort of all of our energy policy decision making, but quite frankly, it is now part and parcel of our broader recovery strategy from COVID-19. And so we intend to make lots of investments and pass policies that are going to not only be able to try and reach those targets, but also to create economic and job growth resurgence. So it's a fundamentally different frame than existed under the Trump administration, which, you know, generally just didn't share that as a global imperative, didn't think that it was a target that needed to be met. But similarly viewed U.S. economic opportunity coming from the energy sector, just the opposite side of the energy sector, right? So the oil and gas and coal communities.
Fascinating. Well, can we just step back then and talk about the Trump administration for a couple of minutes? Because they used energy as a tool of foreign policy. And I just wondered, how did that strategy actually play out?
It was interesting. I mean, I think to be fair, there are going to be similarities and differences between the Trump administration and the Biden administration along these lines. The Trump administration really wanted to, in a way that was fundamentally different than previous administrations, really wanted to take on a somewhat mercantilist approach to thinking about energy and foreign policy, right? So this idea that countries very quickly in the Trump administration learned that if you wanted to make a deal on trade, and trade was sort of, you know, trade skirmishes, trade conflicts, trade differences, this focus on, you know, the balance of trade that the Trump administration sort of put at the top of its economic agenda. If you wanted to be able to deal with them on those terms, which almost every country in the world wanted to, you should put some energy provisions on the table too, right? So you should agree to buy coal from the United States or gas from the United States, or you should talk about, you know, deals in that area. So it became kind of a transactive part of U.S. foreign policy in one way. I would say that very little of that ended up, you know, being, you know, fundamentally different than something we've seen in the past. You know, there weren't a huge number of deals that came out of it. It ended up being somewhat, you know, rhetorical in the end. But it did, you know, it did cause a lot of, you know, interesting feelings, right? And they're not ones that have necessarily gone away, right? So Asian countries, you know, certainly, you know, organized around like a blue dot network, this idea of combating the Belt and Road Initiative with natural gas investments in Asia. Europe, you know, had to, you know, try to figure out how to reconcile the sort of Eastern and Western Europe mindset around gas from Russia and figure out how much, you know, we could figure, you know, try to import from the United States. So there was a lot of that type of thing that was going on. I think that the other piece here is that the Trump administration, in the context of the COVID-19 crisis, you know, really ended up playing a much larger role in OPEC market balancing discussions than we've seen in the past. Even before that, you know, they really, with sanctions on Iran or sanctions on Venezuela, felt quite liberated to make, you know, decisions that were foreign policy related against certain countries that in an undersupplied oil market, there would have been a traditional U.S. sort of reticence to make those decisions. So in a lot of ways, the administration felt emboldened to make more decisions because of their, you know, energy independence, energy dominance. I would say that they didn't necessarily have long-term repercussions or impacts for the energy sector, right? And I'm not sure they fundamentally transformed or unlocked any great foreign policy outcomes either, but it was definitely, you know, energy certainly ended up being part of the equation when they thought about, you know, the foreign policy calculus.
What do you think other countries think about an energy dominant U.S. strategy, and how could that change under a Biden administration?
Yeah, you know, to be fair, I think a lot of other countries made it clear that they thought, you know, energy dominance was a little crass, and so the Trump administration kind of backed off of that term a little bit because they're not, you know, they weren't completely tone deaf in that way. They didn't want to. Nobody likes to be dominated, quite frankly, and so they tried to revise that a little bit. You know, I actually think it's interesting because I think the Biden administration has signaled that energy, but really in the form of a climate agenda, is actually going to be just as central, if not more so, to their foreign policy agenda as, you know, as it was under the Trump administration. It's just very different. And if you think about what is required just to do sort of like transactive support for deals in the oil and gas space versus like fundamentally rework the energy system in record time, you can suppose that under the Biden administration, it's actually going to play a much, much larger role. So energy is going to play a huge role in foreign policy and climate, you know, but it'll all be seen through a climate lens. I mean, you have an actual foreign, you have an actual former Secretary of State heading up as a special envoy for climate change, and he has a seat on the National Security Council. I mean, if that doesn't tell you that those things are going to be deeply intertwined, I'm not sure what does.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because in talking about kind of climate change, one fundamental difference, you know, between the Biden and the Trump administrations has been, as you said, climate change. So realistically, do you think the Democrats will be able to implement what they actually aspire to do?
It's going to be really hard. I mean, I think, you know, if you look at what the Biden administration wanted to do early on in the campaign, it was relatively moderated relative to what some of the more progressive Democratic candidates want to do, right? I mean, it was less ambitious in the sense that it just didn't put quite as many sort of markers out there in terms of what the goals that they wanted to reach. I think what happened though is, and quite frankly, not because they were any less ambitious, but because most of the people in the Biden administration have been in government before and they don't like to promise things that they may or may not be able to deliver on. COVID-19 changed all that, right? You know, if you have an opening to be able to spend trillions of dollars in a recovery package like you couldn't before, you can make some significant down payments on the road to, you know, carbon-free electricity by 2035 or net zero emissions by 2050, or like rejuvenating the U.S. electric vehicle manufacturing industry. So I think that there's a lot of places where they're going to be able to make infrastructure and innovation spending down payments that will be very helpful. The second thing that they'll be able to do is, you know, I look at the first weeks of the Biden administration and see that what they're doing, what they're putting in place through executive order, is essentially what the Obama administration ended up with at the end of the Obama administration. So what took 8 years for them to accomplish before, they're putting in place day one and then some, right? So I think that there is actually quite a bit that they're going to be able to do. Because the last thing I'll say is the on this topic is the bigger shift that's happened is actually within the real economy, right? I mean, so if you just look at the difference in the competitiveness of, you know, batteries or renewables or solar, or even things like CCUS or a discussion on hydrogen or industrial emissions, I mean, it's just we're at a different place. And so I think they'll get a lot more support from investors in the private sector and states and other countries. So I think that they'll actually be able to accomplish a lot, recognizing, though, that the targets they've set for themselves are really, really tough.
Mm, yeah. Well, you mentioned kind of the Obama administration. I would like to come back to compare the challenges facing the Obama and Biden administrations later on in the podcast, if I may. But I would like to come back to a specific international example, which perhaps, you know, really brings some of the climate change thinking in Europe to a head. And that, of course, is the French government's intervention in a proposed LNG deal being pursued by the French company Engie to import natural gas from a major US play. And in October 2020, the cancellation really showed these differing views. I think my question, Sarah, is how was that actually received in Washington?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and it has to do with what I just said about, you know, the real economy having changed. You know, I think that we have this sort of caricatured perspective of, you know, the U.S. oil and gas industry not being forward leaning on climate. And I don't think that that's necessarily true. I think that they're in the difficult position of having assets and resources and shareholders that require them to be able to continue to do their job and produce the resource that they exist to, you know, to be able to produce. And they have to figure out how to sort of navigate into a world where carbon is a much more serious constraint. So that being said, when the sort of impasse over imports to Engie came to the fore, there was a lot of people who were saying, and this is specifically why you shouldn't have methane regulation rollbacks. This is specifically why a government, if they want to be helpful to an industry as critical as natural gas, they have to work with them to be able to try and make sure that they're going to be competitive in third markets. It's not different than other technologies. You don't get to just sell your goods into a different market, you know, now, like, and then have them, you know, not meet the specifications of that market. So there are trade dynamics that go into this. There are, you know, concerns that the EU is going to be fair in their implementation of these policies and all of those types of issues. But I think, you know, one of the things that's important is to say it's really important for the oil and gas industry to be able to be competitive in the context of a transition to a low carbon economy. And that's going to look different in Europe, in Asia, in Africa, in the Middle East. But it's all headed in the same direction. So you either want to be competitive in that future or you want to head off that future. And I'm not sure the US is in a position to head off that future, even if they wanted to. So it really is incumbent upon regulators and people who want to sort of help that industry to actually help them be more competitive. And that means making sure that they can, you know, navigate this energy transition well.
Well, can I, Sarah, for a minute, just delve into something you said in your chat that intrigued me? If I can quote, you know, the first two elements of energy dominance strategy, increasing production of fossil-based energy resources and removing environmental restrictions during a time of global oil and gas oversupply, and increasing concern amongst most major governments and investors about environmental attributes of energy resources, was simply the wrong recipe for success. That's quite powerful. Could you perhaps explain why?
Yeah, I mean, part of it has to do with what I, you know, what I just said about if the world is going to require more stringent sustainability, you know, recommendations on the natural gas industry or whatever the case may be, or criteria, then you need to help them prepare for that, right? And removing regulation and allowing the industry to operate at, you know, either a voluntary basis on those critical criteria is not the right idea, right? It's just not the right move. And because it's not going to help them be more competitive. And so the second piece of that is I was continually sort of, you know, surprised at the sort of the hubris of the U.S. oil and gas industry, where we were pushing so much supply into the market. And it was, you know, the rest of the market was sort of like continually having to adjust. I mean, this has been the story for a huge period of time, right? And if you think about it, it just means that we were selling off US resources at a lower cost, right? And I mean, I know that there's just a competitive dynamic to that. But I mean, for a country that was, you know, at the time, you know, trying to say, oh, we're going to be dominant and we're going to be so strategic about how we're using these resources, it sort of seemed like, you know, selling off a bunch of valuable resources at a very low price in a market that was oversupplied. And I just, that didn't, both of those things didn't seem to make a ton of sense to me. And so I think that it, you know, thinking about if you want to be strategic about your natural resources, how do you think about that? And what's interesting is like the Biden administration is proposing that, but the willing, and I, you know, there's a lot of certainly important considerations about how they're doing that and whatever the case might be. But, you know, there's a lot of folks in the oil and gas industry who see that as being kind of an affront to being able to produce whatever you want and have market access. Whereas I think there's the other side of the ledger there is saying, well, hold on a minute. Like, shouldn't we be thinking about all of the natural resources that come from the U.S. and how we use those over time, not just like racing to produce them as much as we can, right? Is that the right recipe? And so I think it's worth, you know, focusing on what would make the U.S. oil and gas industry as competitive as possible for the longest period of time, taking into consideration that we have this other climate imperative and they need to fit into that equation.
Yeah, and you do say in your paper, you know, that it is this whole decarbonization agenda for the Democrats is not only a challenge, but also it's a huge strategic opportunity. So if I can come back to something we talked briefly earlier on about, and that is, you know, the challenges faced by the Obama and the Biden administrations, you know, are the challenges similar? Do you think, you know, President Biden's going to have an easier time? And I expect also, you know, how do you think US-China relations will fit into this? A big question. Not much time to give the answer. So what do you think, Sarah?
Yeah, in some ways, I'm struck by the parallels between the Obama and the Biden administration, right? I mean, so the Obama administration came in with an economic crisis on its hands and had to think about how to have a recovery. Biden administration's in the same position. There's just a global health crisis, you know, on top of it, which is, you know, a big deal. The dissimilarities are, you know, under the Obama administration, certainly at the beginning, there was still this idea that the U.S. and China needed to figure out a way to reconcile their differences. And we were still on this path of, you know, China joining the multilateral organization system in a positive and productive way. I think the bloom has come off that rose. And I think the thing that's, you know, I always say to people, the thing that's changed most fundamentally in U.S. politics in the last four years has been the U.S. relationship with China. I mean, there is so much antagonism in that relationship. There's so much distrust and there's so much concern on the U.S. side that we need to be able to compete with them. And to be candid, like, this is why I actually think that climate change is such an important strategic opportunity, because I can't imagine the world moving in a productive direction if the whole world order is going to be kind of, you know, shaped around a tension between the U.S. and China, looking out for their interests alone. I think that that's going to quickly lead to a race to the bottom. I think that that's going to lead to, as close to sort of a world decoupled as we can get, because there's just not a lot of room for the two of us to be able to cooperate. If climate change is the frame, right, that's a global agenda. That's a global need. It's not the U.S. looking out for the U.S. and China looking out for the U.S. It's kind of like them looking out for themselves in those contexts. But there's a broader global need that should constrain both behavior. It should allow for competition between the two that leads to a race to the top. It should allow for, you know, cooperation between the two. And it's something that you know, is fundamentally, it's sort of like we're trying to attack another challenge, not just, you know, necessarily each other's self-interest. And that to me seems, and there's very, very few other challenges that are as big as climate change that could serve the same function.
Well, let's just explore for a few minutes the couple of issues of the low carbon agenda. I expect, first of all, you know, what are the opportunities, you know, that the United States could actually achieve in pursuing that agenda? But then secondly, you know, what would the implications be of pursuing that on, say, the US shale industry and oil and gas exports? So how do you play those two out?
Yeah, so I think the big near-term opportunities for the low-carbon agenda are, quite frankly, innovation investment and infrastructure investment. The US has not engaged in enough maintenance and innovation in the basic infrastructure that makes us a successful economy. So this is, along with a bunch of other areas of infrastructure, like, this is what we need to do. If we want resilient systems, we need to reinvest. And so I think there's just huge opportunity to make the economy more efficient and function better and to create jobs by making those infrastructure investments. And everyone's agreed on this, you know, for so long that it's really just time to, you know, get about the business of doing it. And on the second side is innovation, right? I mean, we just as I was saying before, the United States is a very innovative economy, but we've, you know, relied on a system of innovation that allows for the innovation to sort of spread far and wide around the world by design. That is a good thing. But there's also a need to make sure that you innovate in a way that for the technologies that keep your system, your economy running, you also have some resilience there, right? So you know how to manufacture some of those technologies. You have some wherewithal of like what your supply chain vulnerabilities are, right? I mean, we're just in a different world now. And so we do need to think about innovation that's not just about creating the best ideas in the world, but innovate deployment-led innovation, being able to manufacture some of those technologies. And again, that helps solve with some of the sort of, you know, jobs and economic opportunity issues that we have here as well.
It's interesting because talking to Michal Maiden at the Institute in one of our other podcasts on China, very similar story, you know, using energy transition, using technology advancement, you know, to increase technology and also to provide jobs. It's a similar type of discussion. But let me end up, if I may, on this podcast, Sarah, with a forward-looking question, because it's a bit of a tradition when I do these interviews. I like a forward-looking question at the end. So, you end your chapter by saying, While the era of energy dominance may be over, the intensity of clean energy competition is just getting started. A very exciting statement. So can you perhaps expand on this for our listeners and perhaps tell us how you think it's all going to end up?
It's a great question. I'm not sure I have a great answer to that because we're spending a lot of time at CSIS focusing on what clean energy competition looks like. Because if you look at the way that we have thought about at a strategic level, the oil and gas industry, energy security in that industry, vulnerability to supply shocks in that industry, like what are our core interests? What do we invest in at home versus what do we, you know, rely on allies for? Just the whole amount of sort of strategic attention we've given that industry. And then you look at the clean energy space, we haven't done nearly as much. And so we're not even thinking about, you know, Chinese dominance in the existing clean energy supply chains. We're not thinking about what the supply chains for a, you know, like industrial emissions decarbonization might look like. So I think that what we're going to see is a world where there is a real race and a lot more government intervention, not just to try and pursue these low carbon pathways, but to be a winner in those worlds, right? And so that means competition. And it's not competition just in a sort of like normal market sense. It will feel frenzied because if we are to do this, we have to do it very fast. And so I think that it's going to be a world of a lot of not coherence, right? I don't think we're all going to do this in the same way and lock arms and, you know, have globally linked cap and trade systems that tell everybody how to act. It's going to be a lot of competitive industrial strategy. And that's going to mean that different countries will move at different speeds. And it brings up a world of a lot of potential conflict. And so I think we're going to have to manage our way through. And the real thing that we're interested in focusing on is like, how do you make that a positive and productive race and not a sort of negative and destructive race? And I think we can do it. I mean, I think that there's a lot of really interesting and important potential to both cooperate with the private sector and the public sector in reaching some of those goals. But it's going to take a lot of time and attention to make sure we navigate that all very well.
And I think, Sarah, what you've also done, you've really very clearly expressed what an exciting industry we work in. Any young people listening to this podcast, I urge you, come join us because it's a fascinating sector. Well, look, Sarah, thank you so much for your time today. As always, it's been lovely to chatter, and I've really enjoyed our conversation that builds on your kind of paper from the Oxford Energy Forum, Lessons from a Strategy of Energy Dominance, that was recently published by the Institute.
David, thank you so much. It's always such a pleasure to talk with you on these topics.
I hope that you've all enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.